Hey there, I'm Josh Rushing, and welcome to the stream. It's been 2 months since devastating earthquakes in Syria and Turkey killed more than 50,000 people and displaced millions. On the front lines of the disaster were humanitarian workers themselves, where they're both living through the trauma and the loss and the destruction while also working to provide life-saving support. So today we ask, how are the humanitarian workers recovering as they continue to respond? But first, let's hear from Zahra Albarazi, head of research with the Syrian Legal Development Program.
The earthquake that hit us was so intense that no nation could have dealt with it on its own. Despite this, the international community provided no support for those in northwest Syria. The United Nations and the states left the burden completely on aid workers and aid volunteers living there. Individuals who themselves were often victims. Some had recently been made homeless, some had lost loved ones. What this has meant is that many have not had, till today, the privilege of the time or the space to be able to process or to mourn what happened to them, what happened to their families, and what happened to the communities that they live in.
Joining us to discuss, Alvaro Rodriguez, UN Resident Coordinator in Ankara. In Marash, Sima Gnel Karas Manolo, Director of Support to Life, a humanitarian organization in Turkey. And with us from Amsterdam, Sherwin Kazım, an officer with Doctors Without Borders. One more seat at the table, of course, is you. If you're watching this on YouTube right now, see the box over there, you can get a comment to me and I can get them to our guests so that, you know, we could do this thing together, right? Now, let me give you an update on this earthquake. It happened early in the morning on February 6th with devastating results. 50,000 dead, millions displaced. And I want to begin with Alvaro. Alvaro, can you give us an update here 2 months on? Where are we with the humanitarian response to this and what's needed most?
Well, in Turkey, the response has actually proceeded rather well. It did not face the challenges that northern Syria faces. But I can speak about Turkey specifically. One of the major challenges really is shelter. We have people staying in tents, temporary camps, some rather well-established camps set up by the government. But the reality is that living in tents is really only a short-term solution. So to the extent possible, we want to make sure that families, people that, of course, have gone through an extraordinarily difficult situation, can actually return to the extent possible to a normal way of life. And of course, living in tented camps means that issues related to water, food, sometimes are more complicated. And very importantly, men and women and children are affected in different ways. So we need to make sure that we can provide support to the different citizens and refugees from Syria and Turkey based on the needs they actually feel. And for a young child that may have gone through the shock of a lifetime, for sure, we need to make sure, for example, that we have psychosocial support, that we can get them engaged in play and in school to be able to provide, you know, some degree of normalcy for them after this terrible tragedy.
And that's on the Turkey side of the line, where the earthquake also struck in Syria. Sherwin, I want to ask you for an update on what the humanitarian response in Syria is like right now.
Yeah, thank you. 2 months after the earthquake, actually, Syria is facing a double emergency and a double crisis. It's a crisis of a natural disaster mixed with a man-made disaster. More than 6,000 deaths were recorded in Syria. Around 12,000 injuries were reported in all parts of the area. Many houses, many accommodation are destroyed. Infrastructure is damaged. And the basic necessities are missing, such as electricity, fuel for whether for ambulances, for facilities, or to generate electricity. Unfortunately, 555 medical care facilities were either partially or fully damaged, which also added another layer of challenges to a response medically to what's going right now. There are thousands of homeless people, more than 180,000 people are displaced. They are added to 2.8 million internally displaced people in this area in west northwest Syria, and they are in basic need for shelter, clean drinking water, wash facilities, and heating equipments. Especially the weather is still quite difficult. In March only, There were a lot of floods that destroyed many tents in more than 22 camps, internally displaced people camps. There is a huge need to escalate and improve the humanitarian response in this area.
Yeah, and so I want to bring in a piece of video. This is from Salam Mahmoud. She is a rescuer with white helmets. This is what it was like day of.
At around 6:30, 7:30, we were called in after the collapse of the buildings and the destruction, so we headed to the closest location, which was Milis. When we got there, I saw the catastrophe, and I wasn't expecting to see the amount of destruction that I did. When I saw the scenes of the martyrs, the children, the women, all of them under the rubble, I forgot about my family at home. My sister, who I lost touch with and who was in Turkey, all I could think about was how can I get the children out? If there is someone alive, how can I reach them and get them to the nearest hospital?
So, Sima, here's where I want to really focus in on the point of today's show, and is checking in with the humanitarian workers who both suffered the earthquake but are also on the front lines of helping other people. Can you talk to me about what it was like for you when it happened, and how did you deal with both the personal trauma but also being that first line of help for people?
Hi, Josh. It has been very, very difficult for us because as a humanitarian organization ourselves, we're there to respond to the needs, but then being affected ourselves has been particularly very, very difficult. This was an area, the earthquake affected area is you know, we had many offices and teams on the ground because as a humanitarian organization, we were responding to the refugee influx from Syria since 2012. So we actually had quite a big program and we had huge teams in the border areas, the area that was affected by the earthquake. So we have been affected ourselves, many of our staff. We're quite a huge organization. We also have a lot of community volunteers. We have volunteer committees in the area. So a large number of staff were themselves affected. And it took us a while to recover from that, to get back on our feet so that we can actually start planning our emergency response and our humanitarian programming. And that has been quite a challenge. Also because of the scale of the disaster. We've never seen a disaster before of this scale. So we're struggling, but now we have started our operations, and we're actually covering quite a variety of needs in the region.
So looking to our YouTube audience, we have a number of comments here where Sky Meadows says, I've been so worried about the children. Gavin Lepper says, 50,000, that's crazy. How many people were hurt to the point where their life has changed forever, the kids? I cannot imagine. It must be akin to war. So, Sherwin, I want to go with you, because not only is it akin to war, it's kind of overlapping war in northern Syria there, right? How are people dealing with both? What happens when this kind of thing happens where war is already happening?
Yeah, it's really a good question. The problem is that Syria is going through a man-made emergency since 12 years. We are already in the 13 years of the Syrian conflict. Already many people were several times repeatedly displaced to several locations. A lot of them were living already in clusters of camps without access to clean drinking water, without a decent shelter, without an access to the basic services in this area. And what's happened with this earthquake, it's added another layer of challenges and difficulties to these people. What made it even harder is the disaster of the humanitarian situation in northwest Syria, the fact that there are 4.4 million people in this area, depending on one humanitarian access that is connected to Turkey. And there is no even a decent, good referral system to refer people to any other place besides Turkey. That's why when the emergency and the earthquake, the emergency resulted by the earthquake hits the area, we had no referral mechanism. So the people and also the white helmets were the only one were able to get people out of the debris and the rubbles. For us, it was really very difficult to see those people who are going through 12 years of misery and entering a new stage, a new phase of misery. Let's not forget 12 years of conflict, COVID, cholera outbreak, and now this emergency resulted from the earthquake. It's really, we need really to improve and escalate the humanitarian response in this part of Syria.
Yeah, it's like Dante's levels of hell. Like, how many levels are there when you talk about it's a new level of misery? What else could happen there? Look, I want to bring in another piece of video here. This is Houssam Al-Nahas, a researcher, Physicians for Human Rights.
For 12 years, healthcare providers in Syria have endured systematic targeting as part of a wider strategy to weaponize healthcare. Yet, motivated by their commitment to serving their patients and saving lives, we see medical professionals who refuse to leave the country, working tirelessly to support their communities and provide medical care. This is what helped me and many colleagues cope with the security threats, lack of resources, and unstable humanitarian access during my time in Syria. And this is what I currently hear from those who are still on the front line of service provision. The devastating earthquakes that hit Syria and Turkey added a new burden on healthcare providers and humanitarian workers who became on both sides of the equation as survivors as well as service providers. I have talked to many colleagues who are still dedicated to support their communities, and this is what gives them the energy to keep the work that they are doing.
So, Varo, that's hearing some of the challenges on the Syrian side of the border. What are some of the biggest challenges on the Turkey side of the border in addressing this?
Yeah, well, let me just comment on Syria, because like so many humanitarian colleagues, we've seen these things happening in many parts of the world. And what shocks me sitting on this side, on the Turkey side, is that just across a line in the map, you see such a different and considerably more difficult situation. But in Turkey, the level of displacement has been tremendous. We've got millions of people that have actually left the earthquake zone for safer areas to be with their relatives or simply out of fear. While you have other people that have had to just set up tents or even just some kind of accommodation with plastic sheeting to be able to stay near their houses to see if they can rescue something, or near their land or their animals if they live in the rural areas. So one of the challenges that we see as we move, you know, through this humanitarian phase into some form of recovery, which is, of course, very possible and doable in Turkey, a very difficult situation in Syria, of course, is that we need to restore their livelihoods. We need to be able to get people back to, again, some degree of normalcy after this terrible tragedy, restart the economy, because the 11 provinces that were affected in Turkey have 15 million people as population, and that includes 1.7 million refugees. So the needs are huge, and we need to be able to restart the economy and, of course, continue to provide the social services in more of a normalized way. But we hope, of course, that this will happen gradually.
Jump in there, Sema.
I wanted to add to that. There has been extreme trauma and loss in the region. So there's been a need for psychological first aid and also for psychosocial support. And this is an area that we're working in. Already prior to the earthquake, we had big teams of psychologists, social workers, psychosocial support staff, and we've been able to mobilize them. And this has, been great in terms of really covering that need. Yeah. for psychological well-being. Also, you know, crisis situations create inequalities, and we have a very strong protection focus. So we're looking at children who need specific needs, women who have specific needs. Going back to routines is a great way of healing. So looking at how we can provide some of the services, that people are accustomed to, in addition to the economic recovery, which is going to help as we see more and more of an economic recovery. People then feel that they are less in need of aid and going back to routines. So I wanted to add that as well.
Can I want also to add one thing, actually. What I wanted to add actually also is related to the mental health for the humanitarian worker themselves. Humanitarian workers are also part of these populations, mm-hmm. and they are going through the same challenges that this population are going through. That's why it's very important for to be taken also into consideration in this psychosocial support, that they are able to take care of themselves to stay alive and also to take care of others and to support them them also. It's not easy to be vulnerable and support other vulnerables, to be honest.
Hey, Sherwin, this is exactly what I want to talk about. We have a couple of video comments from our community. This is from Nabras Haj Hamdan, who is a humanitarian worker in Idlib, and from Sosin Azmed, who's a communications manager for the Syria Relief and Development. Listen to this, and then Sima, we're going to come back to you after this for an answer.
Even before the earthquake, the scale of the humanitarian needs here was far beyond the capacity of any single NGO. But aid agencies operating in this region have always complemented each other. Some of us deliver rehabilitation projects and others deliver clean water and shelter. Aid agencies are now partnering to offer psychosocial support, but 1 million people need the support and only 24 psychologists are available. Funding for this need must be brought to the forefront of earthquake response.
The impact of the earthquake on our aid workers has really exposed the gaps in the humanitarian sector in ensuring that they're protected in the face of a disaster. This has to include their physical and psychological well-being. With the amount of trauma that they have endured, we have to make sure that they're getting the support that they need. If they can't take care of themselves, they can't take care of anyone else.
Sima, are the people in your organization, the people providing the support, are they getting the psychosocial help that they need? And if so, what is it? If not, what do they need to get?
Yes, this has been a challenging area for us, Josh, because, as a humanitarian organization, we have the reflex to respond to cover needs, to assist people in any way we can. And we have actually been slow in acknowledging the fact that we need to take care of ourselves first before we can help others. It's 60 days into the earthquake, and we've been, working day in, day out. But now we're really starting to feel the heaviness of what we're trying to do. But at the same time, the need to take care of ourselves. So this is definitely an area as management team that we're looking at doing better at.
How about you, Sima? Are you getting the psychological help that you need?
I'm trying, Josh. This is something I'm trying to remind myself and also my teams.
I'm worried that you're not.
But an area we need to do better at.
I think you're putting on a brave face, and I'm worried that you're not. Alvaro, we're getting some comments from YouTube. Yeah, jump in there.
Yeah, no, I wanted to jump in because one of the challenges one often has with psychosocial support is that there's some stigma associated with it. Mm. Oh, you're seeing a psychologist, you need help, you are not as strong as you should be. And it's very important for everybody to recognize that all of us at one point in our career are facing difficult situations. And particularly, of course, our national colleagues that lost relatives, that have relatives that have become disabled as a result of the earthquake. You need to be able to talk to a professional that can help you manage these things. And then you can recover better. The country needs to recover, but of course you yourself need to recover.
100%. And I'll say right now, I'm not in an earthquake zone and I'm in therapy. I'm seeing someone. And so if I'm doing it here in Washington, I guarantee you, who's surviving this there. But Alvaro, what I wanted to, we have some comments from our YouTube audience, and someone here, Ravi Bharath, is asking about what are the challenges and risks faced long term for the humanitarian workers in Turkey and Syria? What will this mean in terms of, do you run out of supplies? Do you run out of tents? How do you look at this in more of a year's perspective than a day's perspective?
Yeah. Well, one of the challenges all humanitarian operations have is that in a world that is so complicated, where you have crisis in Yemen, in parts of Africa, the war in Ukraine, money is finite. And we are all competing for these resources, which we believe these people deserve. because this is basic humanity, a basic characteristic of being human beings. But luckily, in the case of Turkey, we are being able to meet most of the requirements. Maybe not as fast as we would like to, of course, but things are being supplied efficiently. My concern is what's happening in Syria, just as a human being in this planet, that as all the colleagues have mentioned, not enough is reaching. There are not enough institutions, and the border posts from Turkey to Syria to provide the aid are very limited. So you need a lot more.
Yeah, we have another comment from YouTube. This is Imran Dar, who says, how can people in other parts of the world help the earthquake victims? How can other countries contribute? Well, listen, Imran, if right now, well, don't go now, but go after the show. I'm going to tweet out, Al Jazeera's got you covered. We have a whole article with links on how you can help. And I'm literally tweeting that from my computer now. So you can find that there. But Sima, or let's go back to Sherwin, actually, because I know it's harder to get the aid to Syria. What can people around the world do to help there?
You know, I think this moment is very good. We need to spread the word. We need the world to be aware that there is still a crisis and emergency in Syria. Mm-hmm. Before this earthquake, there was a fatigue of Syrian news. Not, we couldn't read, normally Syria was on all the breaking news in every channel, more or less. That's why I would say armed actors, other political actors were also trying to do something in this crisis. But recently, especially since COVID, a lot was stopped, unfortunately. Now with the earthquake, Syria is under the light again. And what I want to say here, one of the most important things that everybody should talk about, that everybody should communicate about, is the very vulnerable access issue. The access is only through one humanitarian corridor. There are two extra being opened in 13th of February, but only for 3 months. That means we have 1 month left. 1 month, only 1 month left. I hope there is a lot of talk going on to extend these humanitarian corridors, and not only in northwest Syria, also in northeast Syria, in all around Syria. The Syrian population, whether under the Kurdish administration in northeast or northwest or in the government-controlled area, they need the humanitarian support. And this access issue is making it very difficult. But also, this area is going through even further because of the lack of safety, lack of security. The people lost their livelihood. A lot of people have nothing for more than 12 years. We need to support them to be able to take care of themselves, to be able to respond to such an emergency, God forbidden, if it's happened soon.
Okay, Sima, I've got just about 2 minutes left here. What can people do to help the humanitarian providers, not just the people on the ground, but the actual humanitarian providers? Is there something that our audience can do?
Josh, actually, I want to emphasize the fact that there is quite a bit going on outside the formal humanitarian system. You know, Turkey has a strong civil society, and civic groups, local organizations, local businesses, or private sector in general, they have all mobilized their resources to support. And we as an organization, we're looking at community-led action, community-led efforts, to really recover from what people have lived through. They know, they best know, you know, what they need and what they need to recover. So any kind of assistance for community-led action is the greatest support.
Yo, this is kind of a specific question, and we're down to the final minute of the show, but Avara, I wanted to ask you because we've heard reports of armed groups that have actually been affecting the ability to respond with aid. I imagine that must be more in Syria than in Turkey, but have you heard about that in Turkey as well?
We heard of one situation in the southernmost province that was affected and affected very badly, Hatay, at one point. But in fact, the police, the law and order services in Turkey have been very effective in containing that. I'm sure there are certainly tensions. But other than that incident in Hatay, I personally have not heard of anything more. In Syria, of course, it may be different.
Well, I want to take this moment to thank all of you for being on our show today, because I know that you're busy and I know you're doing important work. Avara, Sima, and Sherwin, so thank you for taking time to share this information with our audience on the stream. And I hope that our audience can actually maybe do something to help you there. For everyone joining us, thank you for watching. We'll see you next time.